Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on childish labor laws when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. We've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Listen to James Nielsen now. Nielsen is a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's a law school professor. Here's what he had to say about these budding young lawyers. He said, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. A student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, you remember that the 10 Planks to the Communist Manifesto deal with such things as free education for all children in public school. And not only do they deal with free education, but also this thing of child labor. Well, Bill Cosby, the black comedian, has had quite a bit to say recently about black children, black youth, and the work and the ethics and the filthy, perverse behavior and the lack of education and the acting white. Well, there are two other black conservative writers, Dr. Thomas Sowell, S-O-W-E-L-L, and Walter E. Williams. And I thought it would be well worth our time to listen to what the black conservative writers have to say about contemporary America and black youth. Dr. Sowell starts off like this. In an article called Childish Labor Laws, he said, there was a certain irony in a recent news story about the government cracking down on Sears because the department store chain was accused of having hired some workers who were not quite old enough to be working, according to the child labor laws. Richard Sears, who founded the company, was younger than these workers when he began working. So was Aaron Montgomery Ward. Even younger was James Cash Penny, Jr., the founder of the chain of stores that bears his name, Penny's. When J.C. Penny was an 8-year-old boy growing up on a family farm, his father told him that he was not old enough to buy his own clothes. Moreover, neither his parents nor his older siblings would tell him how to get the money. He had to figure that out for himself. As the older children had had to do before him, with a hole in his shoe, he had a special incentive to go find some work to do. These department store magnates were not unique in starting to work at an early age. John Jacob Astor, who would eventually become the richest man in America, left home and began working at lowly jobs as a teenager. So did future Wall Street financier Jay Gould and future steel magnate Andrew Carnegie, future oil tycoon John D. Rockefeller, the future founder of the American automobile industry, Henry Ford, and the future radio pioneer David Sarnoff, who created RCA and NBC. All of these rich, powerful American millionaires and successful businessmen were self-made men. What if our wonderfully compassionate and overzealous social crusaders had been around then and had managed to put a stop to this child labor? Would these energetic young fellows have been diverted into midnight basketball or perhaps gone into the underground economy and possibly crime? If they had ended up in jail or on welfare or on drugs, the social crusaders would undoubtedly have come to their rescue with halfway houses or other programs that would have made them wards of the state. Meanwhile, the social crusaders would feel good about themselves because of all of the benefits that they were showering down upon these less fortunate and doing it with taxpayers' money. Do-gooders, not the only people with a vested interest in restrictive child labor laws. Labor unions have always supported and promoted laws that keep young people out of the workforce, where they would otherwise compete for jobs with the union's own members. Since these young people have to be warehoused someplace while they're kept idle, unions have also been big supporters of compulsory attendance laws that keep teenagers in school, even when they are learning nothing except irresponsibility and drug addiction and the self-indulgent mischief-making. The education establishment itself has, of course, been all in favor of keeping teenagers in school long past the point of where it is accomplishing anything, except providing jobs for teachers and administrators who are themselves paid by taxpayer money. Those jobs are not a small thing as far as the National Education Association is concerned, and the NEA, with its millions of dollars in campaign contributions, is no small thing as far as the politicians are concerned. At one time, child labor laws were used to stop youngsters whose ages had not reached double digits from working in exhausting and dangerous factories and mines. Today, these same laws are used to keep big, healthy teenagers from handling pieces of paper in air-conditioned offices. Education is, of course, important. But like many other things that are important, how much of it makes sense varies from person to person, as well as according to circumstances. Not everyone should continue on to get a PhD and then receive a postdoctoral fellowship. The point along the way at which it makes sense to stop cannot be determined by simply saying that education is a good thing or by calling people dropouts, when they decide that they have had enough before third parties want to turn them loose. Much of what is called education is glorified babysitting, nothing more and nothing less. It produces little more than artificially extended adolescence. The stringency of today's compulsory attendance laws and child labor laws prevents many young people from getting the kind of maturity that can only be found in work and in personal responsibility. If nothing else, many teenagers need to get out of their adolescent subculture and into an environment where they can draw upon the experience of adults around them, instead of absorbing the fads of similarly immature peers. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Thomas Sowell and read features by other creators, syndicate columnists, and cartoonists, visit the Creators Syndicate webpage at www.creators.com. Thomas Sowell is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at the Stanford University, Stanford, California, 94305. Keep in mind now that Dr. Thomas Sowell is a black man. Now, you wouldn't think that a black would make such statements about child labor laws, any more than you'd expect the blacks to turn down welfare, food stamps, Social Security, aid to families with dependent children, stand on their own two feet, and go to work. I've mentioned this before. Black America was a whole lot better off, more self-sufficient. They were in control of their lives and their families 100 years ago in greater proportion than they are today. We have made them wards of the state. We have done nothing constructive for the black man in America. We've made him dependent. It's good to read from time to time an article written by another black man, a conservative, who says, "Let me tell you what I think about these childish labor laws." Now, there's another black writer here, a fellow by the name of Walter E. Williams. And he wrote an article here called "The Nanny State." Listen to Walter Williams in "The Nanny State" and see what you think about this. He said, "Worrying about bacteria, New Jersey banned restaurants from serving eggs sunny side up. The ban has since been lifted. Some New Jersey localities have a ban on people pumping their own gasoline. Policemen issue citations for driving without a seatbelt. By law, new cars must be equipped with airbags. Federal law mandates that all new toilets flush using a paltry 1.6 gallons of water and has now created a black market in used toilets all over America. Georgia's governor mandates that classical music be given to all new mothers so as to aid infant IQ development. California has banned smoking in bars." Now, Bill Clinton wanted a law passed banning smoking within 100 feet of a federal building. In parts of Ohio, children who are going out trick-or-treating must obtain a special permit. These intrusions and more were recently revealed by television journalist John Stossel on ABC's 2020. The state and stated motivation behind this gross intrusion and criminalization of private behavior is to protect us from making unwise choices. Stossel asked Ricardo Martinez, he's the head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, "Why can't people at least have airbag on-off switches?" Martinez responded by saying that society makes decisions about what benefits most people, and most people benefit from airbags. Stossel interviewed Yale University's Professor Kelly D. Brownell. He's the director of the Center for Eating and Weight Disorders, who thinks Americans eat too many hamburgers and french fries. Brownell wants government to tax fatty foods and those with little nutritional content and use the proceeds to subsidize fruits, vegetables, and other nutritious foods. He has suggested that some of the tax proceeds be used to build bike and hiking trails. Well, I'm wondering just when Americans are going to decide that we've had enough government meddling in our lives. It is nobody's business whether I eat eggs sunny side up, drive without wearing seat belts, or pig out on hamburgers and french fries. And I'd like someone to show me Congress's constitutional authority for the government protecting me from making these unwise choices. Those who believe that government should be in the business of making us take care of ourselves should tell us where it all ends. Should government decide what time we go to bed? After all, sleep is vital to good health, is it not? Should government force us to exercise, read wholesome literature, and bathe regularly? You know, exercise, wholesome literature, and bathing are good for us, aren't they? Now, the people who advocate a nanny state government, a better term is Nazi government, are cowards. And you say, well, what do you mean, Williams? Well, let's take Brownell. If Brownell doesn't want me to eat that Big Mac and French fries, let Brownell walk up to my table and remove them from my plate. Now, he doesn't want any part of doing that because he doesn't want to meet his maker this year. So he prefers using the brutal forces of the police power of the government to take my hamburger and French fries away from me against my will and over my objection, because he's a coward and afraid to do it himself. Now, when I was young, bullies used to pick on me. They used to take my food off of my lunch tray, and they would otherwise harass me. One day, my father gave me some advice, and he told me that if you let a bully get away with one thing, the next day he's going to be doing something else, and the following day, something else again. And he told me that the bullying would never stop until I decided to stand up and fight. And he said that even if I lose the fight the next time that I'm bullied, you stand up and you fight again and let the bully know that when he bullies, win, lose, or draw, he has a fight on his hands. Eventually, he'll stop. He'll give it up in his own self-interest. Now, I think Americans should employ my dad's advice. As long as we stand as lambs before the slaughter, you can bet that there will be no end to Congress's bureaucratic stooges bullying us. And that's just what it is, bullying. Now, remember, that's Walter Williams, another black man, who is voicing his opinion as to what he sees going on in America today. It is refreshing, to say the least. Bill Cosby is refreshing. He said, listen, these black youths who cry out and say, you're just acting white. And they speak a language that's kind of strange. I forgot the name of it. It's something like gibberish or guttural or something. You know, when somebody comes to me and he says something like, hey man, like, you know, man, that's really heavy. I don't want to do business with him, and I don't know of anybody else in my age group or in my social strata that would want to do business with him either. Black people are not stupid. Black people can be educated. In fact, if you go to England, have you ever listened to black people in England or Jamaica? You know, our Secretary of State, Colin Powell, is a black man from Jamaica. He doesn't fit the stereotype of blacks in America, and neither do these two men, Thomas Sowell and Williams. What was Williams' first name? Let me get it for you. Walter E. Williams. Now, let me flip over here and I'll get another Williams for you. Walter E. Williams wrote another article. He calls it Blaming the Past. You hear this quite often. blacks are constantly blaming the whites for the Civil War. And right or wrong, good or bad, the people that permeated or perpetrated the alleged offenses or violations of rights and human rights, etc., are long dead. That was my great-great-great-granddaddy who did that to your great-great-great-granddaddy. That's not me doing that to you today. Williams says, people love the past, and it provides convenient excuses for all manner of individual or group shortcomings. Academic experts, politicians, and race hustlers use history as a cover-up. They point to the ugly facts of slavery, Jim Crow, and discrimination as explanations for the high rates of black illegitimacy, crime, and family breakdown. The connection between slavery and discrimination and what we see today is hardly ever challenged. But I say challenge it we must. Only 40% of black children live in two-parent households. The illegitimacy rate among blacks stands at close to 70%. Illegitimacy rate among blacks, 70%. The legacy of slavery, explanation for today's weak black family structure, loses all manner of credibility when we examine evidence from the past. Even during slavery, most black children lived in biological two-parent families. One study of 19th century slave families, published by Herbert Gutman, The Black Family and Slavery and Freedom, 1750 to 1925, found that in up to three-fourths of the families, all the children had the same mother and father. In New York City in 1925, 85% of kin-related black households were double-headed. In fact, 5 to 6 children under the age of 6 lived with both parents. That was in 1925. Let me pause here and make an editorial comment. Now, you've heard me mention before that the blacks were a whole lot better off at the turn of the century than they are today. Before the blacks got off on welfare and food stamps, before we made them wards of the state and destroyed the black family. And I say we because the blacks were doing just fine. Living by themselves, segregated under Jim Crow, living their lives until we whites got into the picture. And then once we got into the picture and we started directing the policies toward blacks, take a look at what Social Security, welfare, food stamps, and the welfare state has done to the black family. Indeed, look what it's doing to the white families. There isn't anything that government can't do half as well for twice as much. And if there is, let me know what it is, would you? Now get this. Both during slavery and as late as 1920, a black teenage girl raising a child without a man was so rare among blacks as to be practically unheard of. Gutman also found in analyzing data on black families in Harlem between 1905 and 1925 that only 3% of all families were headed by a woman under 30. 3%! 1905 to 1925, black households. Now, scholar and columnist Thomas Sewell found, going back 100 years, when blacks were just one generation out of slavery, we find that census data of that era showed that a slightly higher percentage of black adults had married than white adults. This fact remained true in every census from 1890 to 1940. In absolute numbers, blacks commit most of the crime in the United States. In absolute numbers, blacks commit most of the crime here in the United States. Blacks account for half of all of the arrests for assault and rape and 2/3 of arrests for robbery. Blacks are disproportionately more represented in all categories of felonies except those requiring access to large sums of money such as embezzlement and stock fraud. Criminologist Marvin Wolfgang says, for four violent offenses, homicide, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault, the crime rates for blacks are at least 10 times as high as they are for whites. Close to 90% of the victims of black criminals are black. Listen to that again. 90% of the victims of black criminals are black. Crime turns neighborhoods into economic wastelands, forcing poor people to bear the costs of traveling to suburban malls to do routine shopping or to pay the high prices at local mom-pa shops. If they manage to buy a home, that home is worth less because of crime and wanton property destruction. Poor people are most dependent on law and order for safety and welfare. Wealthier people have the financial resources to protect themselves by taking such steps as purchasing alarms or hiring private guards. An often overworked and overlooked crime cost is that people who are the most upwardly mobile, people are the first to leave. Their replacements are not as mobile, or they care less about neighborhood amenities. The people who leave take with them the social leavening that contributes to vital and stable communities. These politically correct theorists and their theories are that poverty and discrimination is the cause of high crime rates. Well, during my youth in the 1930s and 40s, black neighborhoods were far safer than they are today, and it would be preposterous to suggest back then that there was less poverty and less discrimination in the 1930s and the 1940s than there is today. The level of social pathology seen in many black communities is unprecedented, and it has absolutely nothing to do with a so-called legacy of slavery, unless we're willing to say that slavery has a delayed reaction of four or five generations. Now, that article was written by Walter Williams. You can read features by other Creator Syndicate writers and cartoonists. Just visit the Creators Syndicate webpage at www.creators.com. That's www.creators.com. Well, Williams, Sewell, and Cosby, I think, have hit the nail on the head. The excuses that are being bandied about, that it's slavery that causes all of this poverty, and that it's poverty that causes all of this crime, is preposterous poppycock. In the Bible, God tells us that the cause of poverty is the violation of the economic laws. There are economic laws in the Scripture, believe it or not, and when you violate those laws, they have automatic penalties like usury and interest. When you practice usury, when you pay interest, you lose money. And the poorest people in our country are the people that are paying usury and interest. Evidently, nobody has told them that usury and interest is bad for you. In our state, we've got a thing here called a title loan. You take the title of your car in, and they'll loan you money on it and charge you 118% interest. Can you believe that? 118% interest per year on title loans. And that legislation was passed by a Democratic legislature and signed into law by a Democratic governor. And you think those Democrats are your friends? Friends of the poor? Do you believe that? Well, if those Democrats are friends of the poor, I'd sure as hell hate to see what you call your enemies are doing to you. Let's take a look at Creating Poverty by Dr. Thomas Sowell. He has something to say about poverty. He said, some people worry about the exhaustion of petroleum deposits, and others worry about the disappearance of forests, but the political left has a much more immediate concern, the danger of running out of the poor who are used to justify the expansion of their government programs. While others may worry about this, the Census Bureau is doing something about it. The Census Bureau is planning to redefine poverty. They want to raise the upper limit of the poverty income by about $3,000. And if they succeed, they will create millions more poor people with the stroke of a pen. Then, do not be surprised to see media hysteria about the growth of poverty in affluent America. Now, most people have no idea how many of the political crises that we hear about are simply generated just by the way words are used. There was a time when poverty referred to a lack of food, shelter, or clothing. Today, poverty refers to earning an income below a level which has been arbitrarily selected by politicians and bureaucrats to keep poverty alive and big enough to maintain political support for big government programs. Despite clever definitions used to keep hunger alive on paper and on TV, whenever actual flesh and blood human beings are examined medically, there is very little difference. In fact, there is no difference found between the nutrition that we find in low-income and high-income Americans. Both high-income and low-income Americans get more than the required nutrients, and there is, in fact, a tendency for the poor to be overweight more often than the rich, so the poor in this country are not calorie deficient. Most Americans living below the official poverty level today own their own clothes dryer, a microwave oven, a color TV, and a VCR, things that most Americans in or out of poverty did not own in 1971. No wonder, then, that the Census Bureau has to keep jacking up the definition of poverty in order to keep the poor from disappearing and leaving big government advocates without one of their key arguments for spending and taxing. In an era when a Timex keeps about as good a time as a Rolex, and when no-name jeans wear just about as well as jeans that have someone's name written across the butt, are we talking about hardships? Or are we talking about not keeping up with the Joneses? There's no doubt that there are people who suffer actual privation, even if it is not due to a lack of money, but to their own mishandling of the money that they do have. Karl Marx was poor in the sense, and his family sometimes suffered hunger and other very real deprivations, even though Marx's known sources of income were more than sufficient for him and his family to have lived a lot better than they did. Karl Marx spent money like a teenager all of his life. He frittered away inheritances on various self-indulgences, and then he got very angry at bill collectors who wanted him to pay the bills that he had run up. Karl Marx was simply irresponsible. Nothing is going to stop that kind of poverty. Some sports and entertainment figures who have made millions of dollars during their careers have ended up broke and destitute. A homeless man from a wealthy Eastern family literally died in the gutter in San Francisco some years ago. Now, talk about the poor is grossly misleading when it suggests that these are an enduring class of people. Most of the people in the bottom 20% rise out of that bracket inside of 10 years. Indeed, more of them end up in the top 20% inside of 10 years than remain at the bottom. Now neither the poor nor the rich nor the people in between stay put. Yet intellectuals and do-gooder politicians are always bemoaning the disparities between various income brackets without paying the slightest attention to the fact that people are constantly moving in and out of all of those brackets. Now, if you're talking about people rather than about brackets, most poverty disappears as people get older and move up the economic ladder. Only 3% of the American population remains in the bottom 20% for as long as 8 years. And incidentally, these 20% brackets usually do not refer to 20% of people, but to quintiles of households or families. Now, there are 39 million people in the bottom quintile and 64 million in the top quintile. How surprised, how shocked or outraged should we be to discover that 64 million people usually earn more than 39 million people? Now, the Census Bureau wants to increase the amount of income used to define poverty for a family of four. But families of four do not suddenly appear out of thin air. Are we to say that people who do not yet have enough income to support a family of four should go straight ahead and have children, leaving it to the government to support them because the Census Bureau has jacked up the poverty definition? And that's Dr. Thomas Sewell and Walter E. Williams. Let me give you a biographical sketch or background of Walter E. Williams. Remember, he's a black columnist. And you can reach him at, or find out where his column is published, at www.creators.com. Walter E. Williams was born in Philadelphia in 1936. He holds a bachelor's degree in economics from California State University in 1965 and a master's degree in 1967 and a doctorate in 1972 in economics from the University of California, Los Angeles. In 1980, he joined the faculty of George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. He's currently the John M. Olin Distinguished Professor of Economics, and he has also served on the faculties of Los Angeles City College, 1967 to 69, the California State University, 67 to 71, and Temple University from 73 to 80. From 1963 to 1967, he was a group supervisor of juvenile delinquents for the Los Angeles County Probation Department. More than 50 of his publications have appeared in scholarly journals such as publications, such as Reader's Digest, The Wall Street Journal, Newsweek. He's made many TV and radio appearances on such programs as Milton Friedman's Free to Choose, William F. Buckley's Firing Line, Face the Nation, Nightline, and Crossfire. He's also the author of several books. Among these are The State Against Blacks, later made into a television documentary, America, A Minority Viewpoint, and All It Takes Is Guts, and South Africa's War on Capitalism. In 1981, he began writing his weekly column called A Minority View for Heritage Features Syndicate. In 1991, he joined Creators Syndicate as a part of its friendly takeover of Heritage Features. William sits on many advisory boards, including the Review Board of Economic Studies for the National Science Foundation, the Research Foundation, the National Tax Limitation Committee, the Taxpayers Foundation, and the Hoover Institution. The awards and honors that Williams have received are many. These include the National Fellow at the Hoover Institute of War, Revolution and Peace, the Ford Foundation Dissertation Fellowship, the National Service Award from the Institute for Socioeconomic Studies, and the George Washington Medal of Honor from the Valley Forge Freedom Foundation in 1984 and 1985. He received the Faculty Member of the Year Award from the George Mason University Alumni. He is also a member of the American Economic Association, the Mont Pelerin Society, and is a distinguished scholar of the Heritage Foundation. Williams participates in many debates and conferences and is a frequent public speaker and often gives testimony before both houses of Congress. Well, I wish we had about 5 or 10 more Walter Williams and Thomas Sowells out there. I was very impressed, and I'm sure that you will be too. Now, Walter E. Williams doesn't put PhD after his name, doesn't call himself a doctor either. Now, Thomas Sowell, remember, he's the other black writer. Thomas Sowell was born in North Carolina and grew up in Harlem, and as with many others in his neighborhood, he left home early and did not finish high school. The next few years were difficult ones, but eventually he joined the Marine Corps and became a photographer in the Korean conflict. After leaving the service, Sowell entered Harvard University, worked a part-time job as a photographer, and studied the science that would become his passion and profession, economics. After graduating magna cum laude from Harvard University in 1958, he went on to receive his master's in economics from Columbia University in 1959, and then a doctorate in economics from the Department of Labor, from the University of Chicago in 1968. In the early 1960s, Sowell held jobs as an economist with the Department of Labor and American Telephone and Telegraph. But Sowell's real interest was in teaching and in scholarship. So in 1965, at Cornell University, he began the first of many professorships. His other teaching assignments includes Rutgers University, Amherst University, Brandeis University, and the University of California at Los Angeles, where he taught in the early 1970s, and also from 1984 to 1989. Sowell has published a large volume of writing. His dozen books, as well as numerous articles and essays, cover a wide range of topics, from classic economic theory to judicial activism, from civil rights to choosing the right college. Moreover, much of his writing is considered groundbreaking, work that will outlive the great majority of scholarship done today. Vision of the Anointed, published in 1995, appeared on bestseller lists in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and USA Today. Sowell has been a regular contributor to newspapers, and in the late 1970s and early 80s, he did not begin his career as a newspaper columnist until 1984. George F. Will's writing, says Sowell, proved to him that someone could say something of substance in so short a space, 750 words, and besides writing for the general public, enables him to address the heart of issues without the smoke and mirrors that so often accompany academic writing. In 1990, he won the prestigious Francis Boyer Award, presented by the American Enterprise Institute. Currently, Sowell is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution in Stanford, California. Again, Sowell can be reached at Creator Syndicate webpage at www.creators.com. There's a couple of other articles in here that I thought I'd mention to you, just not articles, but a couple of short pieces. Has anyone heard how Al Gore lives a Christ-centered life? Well, he gave a big speech recently about how important his faith is to him. The amusing part came when he said that his favorite Bible verse is John 16, verse 3. Of course, the speechwriter meant John 3:16, but Gore wasn't familiar enough with the Bible to catch that error. At John 16, verse 3, we found Al Gore's foot in his mouth with, Christ said, quote, "And these things will they do unto you, because they have not known the Father nor me." Here's a second one. You may be interested to know that every 13 seconds, one of America's 70 million gun owners uses a firearm in defense against a criminal. Every 13 seconds. And did you know that American women use handguns 416 times a day in defense against rapists, which is a dozen times more often than rapists use a gun against women? And did you know that a gun kept in the home for protection is 216 times as likely to be used in defense against a criminal than it is to cause the death of an innocent victim in that household? That piece came from Stopping Power, Why 70 Million Americans Own Guns by J. Neil Shulman. All right, let me give you a reminder here. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, I guess I should remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week worldwide over the internet, and for more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to the website at georgegordon.org. Well, let's see what I wanted to tell you here. Getting your share of farm subsidies. I think I'll do a separate program here on farm subsidies and the economic realities of the government supporting farmers. There's a little piece here on gold. Unlike paper money, gold is nobody's fool. Gold, the money with no one's picture on it, rose again on Wednesday. It hit $427. It's the money that no central bank promotes and none destroys. It's the money that exists only in its tangible form, a real metal that you can find on the periodic table. It's the real thing, real money. As money, gold may not be perfect, but we do not argue that it should be worshipped, only that it should be bought. As money, nothing is better than gold. What really drives the world improvers is not charity, but vanity. Paper money has and was a creation of the world improvers, of course. The reason that they prefer it to gold is exactly the reason that gold is better money. Paper is always ready to do their bidding. Gold is not. The world improvers are not interested in private acts of kindness or innovation that might actually make their world better. They propose a ban on world hunger without planting a single turnip. They take up the cause of freedom in other countries and force the liquor store next door to close on Sunday. They insist so strongly on better treatment for women in the Islamic world, they forget to kiss their wives when they leave for work in the morning. But the people in charge of Bush foreign policy are vain world improvers, and the world improvers don't feel that they've done a good day's work unless they've killed someone. All of the greatest world improvers have been mass murderers. Alexander, Caesar, Tamerlane, Genghis Khan, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, even the peaceable improvers, such as Mahatma Gandhi, so upset the order of things that millions of people died in the mess that they left behind. Paper money is a handy tool for the world improvers. They use it like politicians use civil service jobs and generals use heavy bombers. They use it to get their way. Whatever the vapid ideal du jour, it can usually be bought at some price. The poor can be fed and housed. The middle classes can be given free medical care and low-cost house loans. The upper classes can be given contracts and favors. Enemies can be summoned up, bombed, and then reconstructed. All these costs more money than they have on hand. How to get more money for these great new programs, these marvelously worthwhile ideals, these fabulous public spectacles? Gold flatly refuses to cooperate. It doesn't even give a reason. Instead, it stays mute and reticent. Paper money, on the other hand, barely needs encouragement. Start up the presses. Lower the Fed funds rate. Relax reserve requirements and lending standards, and sell more bonds. Create more paper. Paper money is ready to go along with anything. It's like George W. Bush himself. It seems never to have met a boondoggle that it didn't like, and could never tell a phony deal or ideal from a real one. All right, let's see what else is going on here. I got a few more minutes left. Told you about Sewell. Told you about creating poverty. Like I mentioned this, that poverty is created by a lack of land. The solution that God came up with to solve the poverty problem was to give people land. Then when you apply your labor to the land, you will make wealth. Well, let's see what kind of a shorty we got over here. I'm going to save this farm subsidy story here for a program. Organic food sales see healthy growth. There's a MSNBC short. A far cry from the farmers' markets and food co-ops of years ago, organic products are now marketed in major supermarkets across the country, and the industry is enjoying double-digit annual growth. When most consumers think of organic food, dry, boxed cereals, or turkey bacon are most likely to come to mind, but the category now includes foods like wine or even caviar. And thanks to mass marketing and health-conscious consumers who favor foods without synthetic herbicides, pesticides, or hormones, organic has arrived. Just digest last year's harvest. Organic food sales at the retail level totaled $10.4 billion last year, according to Catherine DiMatteo, Executive Director of the Organic Trade Association. This year, retail sales of organic foods are expected to exceed $15 billion, with more than $32 billion projected by 2009, while the conventional food industry still dwarfs the organic sector with $550 billion in yearly sales. It is producing an unappetizing 2-3% growth rate each year, while the organic industry has savored several years of 17-20% growth per year. Now, once you have craft marketing an organic product, albeit through another brand, you really can't be more part of the mainstream than that, said Dom Monturi. He's the editor of Packaged Facts, an industry publication. Kraft owns Boca Burgers and other mainstream food companies, and supermarkets want a piece of the organic pie. Other big players are going organic, including Coca-Cola, which bought Odwalla Natural Beverages and General Mills, which has Cascadia Farm. Walmart and Costco are now among the 700 U.S. companies selling organic as well as conventional food products. Now, all of this competition means organic prices have dropped, often to the same levels as conventional food, but you can still drop $65 on an 18-pound organic turkey. The organic industry is big and it's still growing. The newest Whole Foods market in New York City is more Costco-sized than Manhattan cramped. It boasts 60,000 square feet. The $4 billion a year organic food giant is poised to get even bigger on the national level, riding, if not leading, the wave of organic boom. Organic is just plain better for you, said Nina Rothschild on a recent shopping trip, so I feel that I'm doing the right thing. Consumers can expect to see the mass marketing of organic foods, drinks, and other products to continue, especially in everyday supermarkets. Supermarkets accounted for 37% of organic sales last year, and they're also eliminating obstacles to wider market penetration, including price, quality, and distribution. And I might mention along that line that a company called it's called Wild Oats, is now a supermarket chain scattered all over the United States. And there's one down in Dallas, Texas that has about 7 or 8 supermarkets, and I've been reading more of supermarket-sized organic stores. So the health food stores of the past, the little mom-and-pop operations, will, in a short period of time, be a thing of the past. What we're seeing now is supermarkets that are now merchandising organic produce. Wild Oats even has a food bar, meat counter, fish, as well as all of the other grocery items that you would normally expect, including such things as fruits and vegetables organically grown, which is really a loss or a shortage in most supermarkets. All right, I'm about out of time. The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective 7 days a week. The sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we recommend or endorse will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, or sectarian. They may be racial or ethnic partisans who do not endorse the opinions or beliefs expressed here on the Law Hour and editorial review. Well, let's see, what else have I got here? I guess I should remind you that you are listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the webpage at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.